Do not adjust your settings. Take your hands off the keys. Your search is over. These are the geeks you're looking for. You found Geek Watch 1 with Kylan and Ken.
This is going to be quite a ride.
Hey, Jim! Boom! That's a bad outfit! Boom!
I love you.
Me too, man. Hit me, my turn! Am I the meanest?
Sure enough!
Am I the prettiest?
Sure enough!
Am I the baddest mofo go down around this town?
Sure enough!
Well, who am I?
Sure enough!
The Shogun of Harlem.
For what lies ahead, ready are you?
We're police officers. We're not trained to handle this kind of violence.
Hey, Geeksters. I'm Kylan.
And I'm Ken.
And you found Geek Watch 1.
Welcome back, Geeksters. This is issue 43 of Geek Watch 1. Today, we have a very special gift for you guys. You guys know it's coming. We got the Michael Whitwer interview about Empire of Imagination. It was a fantastic interview. I want to thank Michael again at the beginning of the show here for coming on and hanging out with us. Hopefully, you get a chance to come back on again.
Yeah, that was a really good interview. And, you know, just geeking out, just talking about gaming and just geek stuff in general. He is I think if it wasn't for time constraints, that interview would have been much longer, seriously.
Yeah, we actually did end up going for another 15-20 minutes afterwards that I wish I still had the mic running, but it wasn't as much about the book and things. So, but he did say, I think, as soon as his schedule dies down a little bit, he is going to come back on just to hang out and talk.
Yeah, so that'd be cool because he's into so much more than just D&D. I mean, he's really big into sci-fi, which,
yeah, we can,
you know,
have him
that'd
come
be
on
fun to pick his brain about that.
Yeah, have him come on and we'll just talk late 70s and 80s sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
Just to have a show about that. There's another show I want to do because I was looking up a show on Wiki and I fell down the rabbit hole of Hanna-Barbera. At some point, we got to do a Hanna-Barbera show.
That's only because Vern didn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah. Vernon was asking about a show that they did in the 70s. It was Chan and the Chan-Chan Gang or something like that. You remember that?
I remember that, yes.
So,
I remember that. And, there was a lot of Hanna-Barbera stuff that was so... It was really good, but so short-lived, like Devlin. I love Devlin.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a short-lived show. Blue Falcon.
Oh, yeah, with Dynamite?
Dynamite, yes.
See, what's great is you got to see those on the first run. Me, just being in the next generation behind you, I caught all the reruns of that. They were still pretty popular.
It was Grape Ape in there, too.
Oh, yeah, Grape Ape, Megilla Gorilla. Who else? Hong Kong Phooey was in there.
Hong Kong Phooey.
All of
was that the whole group that was kind of like a takeoff of the Scooby Gang that had Grape Ape in it and they investigated things or something? Or what? They were a band.
And the ape was
they
like right on...
They had Jabberjaws.
Yeah, Jabberjaw was
on but Jabberjaw.
But Grape Ape was part of that.
No.
No, Grape
Ape was...
the
same company, though.
They had Grape Ape and Jabberjaw in the same show.
Yeah, that's probably why I'm thinking.
That's what it was.
Well, Hanna-Barbera did a lot of crossover specials back then, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone showed up on every show.
So, and that was a Hanna-Barbera had for a while there in the late 70s, especially. They had a formula. They had a crazy creature of some sort, and then like four kids, and they would solve mysteries of some sort. You had it with Jabberjaw, you had it with Scooby-Doo, you had it with Josie and the Pussycats tried to do the same thing. There was just a bunch of shows that did that. You had, what was that one with the Dune Buggy? Speed Buggy?
Speed Buggy, yes.
That was another one. It was a crazy creature and a group of kids.
Right.
So it was, but yeah,
wasn't
at some
like
point.
Races?
Huh?
Wasn't there like a racing thing? And
Wacky
it had
Racers.
Muttley?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah, Wacky Races, yeah. Yes.
And the
yes.
Laugh Olympics.
Yep.
Yeah.
Dude, this is, like I said, this is a rabbit hole we're going to have to fall down coming up in a future show.
And actually, looking back on it, and it was a show that probably should not have ever been shown, was Captain Caveman and the Teen Angels. Looking back on that, I was like, oh, that was so wrong.
Yeah, but you were a kid, so, you know,
it
makes sense, and it wasn't wrong at all.
Well, back in the 70s, the politically correct stuff that we have now wasn't as big a thing. Vicky brought it up the other day that, like, people were not getting offended just to be offended back in the 70s.
No, no. We had too much polyester back then in lawn darts.
Well, that's because people knew back then how to laugh and how to laugh even at themselves and not be offended by... Nowadays, people get offended by just the way you look.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
like I said, some people just seems like they want to get offended because they're supposed to be offended by something.
It's because they want to sue you for everything.
So, but yeah, Geeksters, that's a future show we're going to follow because that's a rabbit hole that's going to take us a long way down. Also, we could look. That's another one that maybe we'll just do a series of the old cartoon companies. Cause we could go through Funimation. We could hit Marvel Productions had some good stuff back in the '80s.
We actually talk about anime.
Yeah, I don't know if you call it good, but okay.
Hey, I used
they
to
had
love
some stuff.
I love Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
That doesn't make it good.
Trust me, dude.
Have you watched it recently? Really?
The weird thing was, looking back on it, the Incredible Hulk show. Like, when I was a kid, I didn't like it. But looking back on it, the Incredible Hulk animated show of that time was really good and actually better than Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I kind of had... There was a bit, you know, to be watching that show on Saturday morning... But then Friday night, you're watching The Incredible Hulk. There was a bit of a disconnect because you had the true comic version of Bruce Banner on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
But then you had David Banner who's walking around doing this whole fugitive thing on Friday night.
It confused your brain.
And it confused my brain, you know, because I wasn't really reading Incredible Hulk at that point. So I never thought about that. I think that's the reason why I... was confused by Incredible Hulk. I liked it, but I was confused by it.
Before we go too much farther down the cartoon rabbit hole at the moment, Kylan, what have you guys done this week? Anything special?
Oh, we did... Oh, no?
I was about to say... This week was not... We just tried to survive this week.
This week was full. It was a full week for us, so we just tried to survive it and, you know, managed to do that.
Cool.
So, rinse, wash, repeat.
Cool. Well, this week, actually, I took Vicky over. We had mentioned it last week on the show that only yesterday, the Studio Ghibli film from the 91 that had never been released in North America, we got a chance to go see it.
Voiced by Daisy Ridley.
Yeah. Actually, Daisy Ridley was one of the voices for the English dub on it now.
Yeah, I saw that.
Right.
So, it wasn't my cup of tea. It was an interesting movie, though. Because, like you said, it was in the 60s and late 80s. Because it's this... girl, she
basically talking about her fifth grade life as an adult.
Okay,
but she's like 27, and everyone thinks she's old because she's not married.
Ah, all right.
So, like I said, it wasn't my cup of tea because I like my anime with a little more action in it.
Right,
but there was a packed out house. So the Nightlight Theater is not super huge. You guys went there last week, but it was nice to see that they had actually filled it up, and there was actually a waiting list to see this movie.
Oh wow, that's cool.
Cool.
So.
Oh, you know what? There is something, and I promised to give a shout out. This comes out of Odd Mall.
Right.
Now, at this last Odd Mall, there was a vendor there, and do we have what the name of her company was? Because I had her. Don's looking that up. Anyway. She had these really cool shadow boxes.
Oh, yeah. I saw the pictures.
Yeah. Right. And so I challenged her. I said...
Now, explain the shadow box.
Okay, so anyway...
It's a shadow box that if anyone has seen the what's known as the dimensional decoupage, not the stuff that you glue down, but it's the stuff that you layer. She basically does that with comics. She takes an issue of a comic and layers out the photos, the images in them, and also creates roses out of some of the pages and puts them around the inside, then covers the entire outside frame of the shadow box in the comics as well, in the flat decoupage with the glue and everything.
And then the tops off with an actual glass, not plastic glass. And so I'd seen her booth when we were setting up. And she had this Mighty Morphin Power Rangers one. And I looked at it, and I was like, okay, well, maybe later. And, you know, she also had, I believe there was Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There was a Batman one. There was
Buffy
a Joker
one.
There was just a ton of different fandoms represented. And so I decided that I wanted one, and I gave her a challenge. I said... I would want a Power Man and Iron Fist one, but I want one from the 70s run. And so she goes, okay, challenge accepted. And not even 48 hours after the end of Oddmall, she messages us at GeekWatch 1 with Power Man and Iron Fist number 60 in really good condition. And she said that she was going to read it first before she chopped it up. So I'm like, okay, fine. And then a couple of weeks later, she says it's done and she sends me pictures of it. And in fact, I'm picking it up from her late this afternoon. Mm-hmm. So, awesome. And I told her I would sing her praises. Did we find out what the name of it? The only thing is I don't have the name of her company.
Her name's Tiffany. We'll go with that. And I don't know if she'll be at the next Odd Mall or not, if she said she would, but
I'll find out this afternoon, though.
But yeah, we'll let you guys know about it. And we'll post a picture of the shadow box when we pick it up.
So
but
you have Tiffany.
You have the Tiffany. Two shadow boxes. Bart actually picked up that Buffy one, Vicky said.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, he did get the Buffy
one. Just have to get pictures of all of those and put them up on our site so people can see the multiple different ones she makes.
Yeah, because Kylan did get the Power Rangers one after all.
Yeah, because somebody had told her they wanted it and they ended up leaving.
Yeah.
So I told her I'd buy it off of her. So,
yep, so we do have that one.
So Tiffany, you rose up to the challenge. You got an awesome issue. You knocked it out of the park. I've been looking at the picture several times. I can't wait to get that thing in my hands.
Not surprisingly, a geek rose to the challenge.
Yes.
So there we go.
Oh, and she said she got some cool points from her comic shop because she was asking them about Power Man and Iron Fist. And it seems like she is actually interested in following up on seeing what that whole story is about. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Oh. I thought of something in the middle of that, and I forget what it is now. So, but
I'll come back to you.
Oh, another thing that happened. Well, one Vicky and I actually have coming up. Everybody, go check out this weekend. This is mainly for the older geeksters. Vicky was in a movie. Was it last summer or the summer before they filmed it?
2014.
Yeah, the summer 2014. She was in a movie with Melissa Rauch from The Big Bang Theory called The Bronze that actually comes out this weekend. Vicky and I are going to go to a preview screening on Tuesday, and next week we can let you know what we thought about the movie. But what's awesome is if you go to YouTube and look at the trailer for The Bronze, Vicky's front and center in the trailer.
Cool.
So that's something cool that we got coming up this weekend also. Plus, we also have Concoction coming up this weekend, Geeksters. For next week's show, we're going to have Jesse, our friend, is actually out at GaryCon right now that we had mentioned, and talking to some people there, meeting Mike Whitwer and friends. She's going to come on the show next week, tell us about GaryCon. Vicky and I will actually be at Concoction next weekend, so we'll probably have some stories from Concoction. We'll say hi to Jim and Mark from Tangent Bound. They'll be there. We may pick up an interview with them or something. I'm not sure. So that's what's coming up for next weekend. But also another thing dropped this week in the way of movies, guys, that we didn't even talk about before the show. Did you watch the Ghostbusters trailer?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's actually a lot better than I expected it to be.
It has. I think the trailer itself is fun, and it's got, like, basically a whole kick-ass feel for the ladies, and I think it feels like the original. Like, I don't know what people were necessarily expecting, but it had, like, the team and the whole overall feel is fun, and it just has that feel of the original to me, of the original team and the movie.
Yeah. Well, I was watching it, and when I watched the trailer, I was enjoying it, having a good time. Then I saw Slimer.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, this movie's going to be awesome. So, and actually, Vicky found a thing for any of our adult geeksters. I guess
that is a Bucky fan.
Yeah, but anybody that's a Bucky fan from from the Winter Soldier,
can see his
Sebastian
butt.
Stan, you get to see a lot more of him than you do in the Winter Soldier in the Bronze. So if you go see the Bronze, you get to see a lot of Bucky.
Bucky's butt.
See Bucky butt.
Yeah.
Gonna see Bucky's butt.
So
by the time this comes out, we've already seen Bucky's butt.
Yeah. I wasn't gonna say it that way, but hey.
Hey, I could have gone worse.
Yeah, you could have, but exactly. Not going to.
You weren't on set. But, you weren't on
but
set.
But it's perfectly family friendly.
Exactly.
So but yeah, but with the Ghostbusters, it looks like it's gonna be a lot better than I think a lot of people were expecting. It's gonna surprise a lot of people, I think, because a lot of people when they saw Reboot, they're thinking Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles type of reboot.
Well, see, and the other thing is the trailer lets you know it's not really a reboot. Like, yeah. it acknowledges the original. It says this is 30 years later.
So, and they even show the original firehouse in the trailer.
Exactly.
So that one's...
I think, if nothing else, it'll be fun. Like, it's not going to be bad.
Well, right. that's what made the first ones great. I mean, the first one, the original one wasn't as family-friendly as the second one. I mean, there wasn't anything major, but you could tell it was cleaned up a little bit for the second one.
Yeah.
But both of those were fun movies. That's what most of the movies we remember from the 80s, that was the whole thing. It wasn't whether or not they were the greatest story ever told, or they're going to change the world. They were just out there to have fun.
Yeah. Hey, Melissa McCarthy's character in the thing was funny.
Yeah.
Her in the window.
I think, quite honestly, my favorite already is Kate McKinnon.
Yeah?
I just like her.
Which one's her? She?
She's the one that, at the one point, she was wearing the wig.
Oh, okay.
The purple wig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
No, I just thought it was funny that, you know, the black chick is beating on McCarthy, trying to, like, get the demon out of her. And
she's
the power of pain compels you.
No, come on. Like,
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of people falling.
That's just it. It's going to be fun because it's not uber violent, like, in a horrible, nasty, painful, bloody way, like so many movies. And it doesn't take itself too seriously, obviously. I think that's why it's going to be so much fun.
I think the effects the ghosts look amazing in this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they couldn't help but improve that portion of it.
Yeah,
right.
That, and like I said, Slimer's in it. I mean, you can't get much more Ghostbusters than the Slimer.
Exactly.
So, so what else do we got on any news that happened this week? Kylan, you said there's something about Poe Dameron?
Yeah.
Getting back to that, what's his name? Should be in a dress.
Who?
He's the...
What?
You're talking... No, it's with Ghostbusters. You're talking about Chris Hemsworth?
Almost should be in a dress.
Okay, that'd secretary. Be interesting.
Why not?
Male secretaries don't have to wear dresses, you know?
Yeah.
Why not?
That's kind of sexist.
Champ Tatum wore a dress multiple times.
That's because he's Channing Tatum.
Exactly. Well,
I still say he's going to play Cable and Gambit.
We'll address that another time.
Are we going to wait for our After Dark show for that?
So what?
We gonna wait for the After Dark show to talk about that one?
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we'll just have 10 minutes of Kylan cursing him out.
So what do we have on Poe Dameron?
On April 6th, which is the day that the Star Wars series of Poe Dameron comic comes out, they are having Poe. They decided to make it Poe Dameron Day, so they're encouraging local comic shops to have giveaways and maybe make more of an event out of it. I got in touch with pretty much like what they did with Avengers versus X-Men. Like, our shop had a cake.
Yeah, there was an AVX cake.
There was an AVX cake.
Had like buttons and posters and stuff to give away.
And so it looks like that's what Marvel is getting behind. They're really getting behind this because, well, like the article said, of all the Star Wars novels, we all know that the X-Wing novels were the best. And we all know that, you know, Poe Dameron is just the bomb. So why not make an event out of it? And so we have Poe Dameron Day. And I am so looking forward to this.
He checked with our local shop, and he's going to have some giveaways. They've got, like, buttons and stuff. And also
cool.
I will be there.
Anything to encourage people to get to your local comic shop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing that I'm not as big about the Poe Dameron book coming out is the fact that they canceled Kanan to bring out Poe Dameron instead of just adding it on.
They did not cancel Kanan to bring out Poe Dameron. Kanan was a weak book.
No.
And I will tell you this because Mike on Mighty Marvel Geeks was reading this book on the regular. And he said himself that there were some missed opportunities with this book. And then it's almost like the writers didn't know what they wanted to do with it. They didn't know which way they wanted to go, and it reflected in sales.
Because
you can have many individual series going on within Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw an opportunity with Poe Dameron, just like they see an opportunity with Han Solo, because Han Solo is going to have an individual series coming up as well. So,
I don't know. I think
that was
the only weak is the fact that they make you pay for the second season of Rebels.
Yeah,
the second half.
But that's Disney. That's not Marvel.
That's
but,
the
yeah.
only weak part about it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still upset about that. We've only seen like 3 episodes of the second half of the series because those are the ones they gave us as a freebie, as a consolation prize. Other than that, we have to buy the next season or the other half of the season.
I'm not paying another $20.
So we'll have to figure out a way to watch that.
Right. So we'll be getting, and they've confirmed it's not a miniseries, it's a full-on series, so.
Well, as long as it's popular enough, it'll stay a full-on series.
Well, it's kind of like what happened with Black Knight, because Black Knight ended after 6 issues, because sales just weren't there, so. Yeah.
Well, Canon, when it first started out, was actually supposed to be limited, wasn't it?
It started to be limited, but the initial sales were so strong, they decided to make it a full series.
That may have been where they
made. But then they made changes in the story, and the sales dropped.
Because they had to spread it out.
Exactly. Right. They ended up having to decompress the story, and it actually slowed it down. It may have slowed it down too much.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
At least going into this one, they know they have a full-run series. They can take their time and do it that way.
Right. And, you know, so we have, and I'm pretty sure, now my understanding is this is all pre-episode 7 stuff.
Okay.
So we'll see, you know, a lot of, maybe a lot of his stuff as an early X-Wing pilot, maybe his time at the Academy.
Well, they're basically just giving background on the character.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Hey, maybe by doing this, though, they can show some more of the political landscape of, was he working with the regular New Republic to start with, and then he joined the Resistance, or how's this work?
Well, I guess we'll see.
We'll see.
We can see some more of the background machinations, maybe see where the First Order started out and stuff.
Right.
Yeah, the incredibly exciting political side of Star Wars that everyone loves so much.
There are some of us that enjoy some of that.
I like some of that stuff. That's how
even of the major fans, it's still a percentage of those fans who enjoy that stuff.
And that's the same ones that don't like Jar Jar.
You get the spy stuff out of it, though.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
do we got actually?
I have one more thing to mention about something comic related.
Okay.
For Neil Gaiman fans of his series Sandman, which hugely popular when it was out, they're producing a movie, and one of the big deals about it was that Joseph Gordon-Levitt was going to be part of the movie, and Neil Gaiman was going to be executive producer, that kind of thing. Well, Gordon-Levitt has apparently left the production. That was announced this week. It's kind of a big blow to it because he was kind of the biggest name behind it. And his movies are so good now, like, especially with the stuff that he's producing in that. But hey, basically,
I thought he was great in, G.I. Joe. Kylan's favorite film of all time.
He was in G.I. Joe?
No.
Yeah, he was Cobra Commander.
No, that's not my favorite movie of all time, but okay.
Sure, he was fantastic in that movie. better known as the, we don't want to name him Nightwing, but he's Nightwing from the last Batman movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But basically, it came down to ownership, in a sense, of Sandman going back and forth between Warner Brothers shifting their catalog to Vertigo, and then to, which is an imprint of DC, and then to New Line Cinemas. And I guess Joseph Gordon-Levitt has a bit of a, maybe they don't quite see eye to, he doesn't quite see eye to eye with New Line. And that's kind of what led to him deciding to leave the project. So it has nothing to do with, you know, what was coming out of the script or anything like that, but it comes down to the production company and he just can't work with them. So
yeah,
he actually put, amazingly, because actors don't often do this, or producers or whatever, he posted quite a long little explanation on Facebook to let people know that, you know, it wasn't a problem with certain other things, and it was simply a matter of difference of opinion, and that's why he left. So it's sad to see him go, because, you know, we all know how good he is, but given the popularity of the property, I think they're obviously still moving forward, and hopefully they're still going in a good direction, and we'll see what happens.
That's going to be an interesting, just the history of Sandman itself, the title and the name Sandman is really interesting, because you have multiple characters that before Neil Gaiman got involved or made his version, there was a Sandman back in the 40s in the golden age of DC Comics. Right. So it's like, it's just an interesting story seeing that come up through, and how the this Sandman's a totally different thing. And DC, I think, and through their books and stuff, has tried to retcon to put it so that this Sandman is in the line with the original, but it's not really, it's weird.
Well, I mean, this salmon has nothing to do with being like, it has nothing to do with superheroes and stuff like that, which I think is why, you know, a lot of comic fans on whether DC or Marvel kind of didn't necessarily know how to take it. It's mm-hmm. a fantasy series more than anything.
Yeah.
So trying to fit it in the timeline is a little difficult, but there have been a few. It's just a different take.
Yeah, okay. I think it works a lot better that they've tried to put it back into Vertigo. So they Vertigo is a totally separate universe.
Absolutely. It fits Vertigo much better.
Yeah.
And so, it's to me, it seems like it needs the feel of like Pan's Labyrinth or something. Like it needs that kind of feel to the movie overall. So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Any idea when they originally had scheduled that for release? Is that 2018?
I thought it was within the next couple of years, but honestly, because of like they hadn't even gotten through a script on it or anything. So So it's way out.
Well, that's one we'll just have to keep our eyes on the net and keep watching for it.
I will.
So, but Geeksters, like we said before, we have we got to sit down with Michael Whitwer. He does mention that this week he'll be at GaryCon, but we told you guys we recorded this last week, so obviously GaryCon's over. But other than that, we'll see you at the other side of this. Hey, Geeksters. We're here with Michael Whitwer, author of Empire of Imagination, The Birth of Gary Gygax and the Birth of Dungeons and Dragons. As I mess up the title of your book as we're coming in, welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Ken. I'm thrilled to be here.
You've never been here on Geek Watch 1 before, so a lot of times what we like to do when we bring someone in is find out, what's your geek? We know you like Dungeons and Dragons, obviously. You wrote the first ever bio of Gary Gygax himself. So other than just Dungeons and Dragons, what else do you geek out about?
Well, I grew up with all things geeky, really. I mean, so I grew up in the 80s, and so this, you know, like the movies, the VHS tapes we had at home were like Tron, and we had a back-to-back feature VHS tape, my dad must have recorded it for us, that had Buck Rogers, the pilot, followed by Flash Gordon. The truth is, pretty much everything Dungeons & Dragons, but everything sci-fi in particular. As a matter of fact, I probably grew up with more sci-fi stuff when I really think about it. I mean, even in my role-playing experience, we played a long, long-term version of the Star Wars West End Games version of Star Wars role-playing game.
Oh, years and years. I love that game.
It was all Star Trek, original series, Star Trek TNG, probably more sci-fi than anything. So I guess that's my geek.
Wow, you fall right into our wheelhouse here. We'd love the sci-fi. But
oh, yeah.
So going into, while we have you here for the book, where did you actually get started writing this book? What is this book actually about? We've told our fans, our listeners, what it's about from our point of view, but you're the man who actually wrote this book. So when you came at it, what is this book for you?
Sure. It's a labor of love. First and foremost, this is a book for gamers by a gamer. I mean, first and foremost, everything from the style to the way it's written to really the content. It's really about, it's really about a guy that I think deserves a lot more pop culture credit than he probably gets. I mean, there's this element, you know, when I was investigating this, as originally it was a thesis topic. I was actually, the original version of this book, or I should say an early version of this book, was a master's thesis at the University of Chicago. And I was looking for a topic of something I was really passionate about that I could get excited about. And I tripped on this article about Gary Gygax that was written shortly after he passed away in 2008. And I was just really surprised because, you know, I had mentioned I grew up in the 80s. This is what, of course, a lot of geeks and gamers refer to as the Satanic Panic around D&D.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Right, all this controversy and uproar over this controversial game that was psychologically dangerous, that was in league with the devil, all this crazy stuff. And so to me, Gary Gygax, I never thought much about the guy other than the fact that he was on the front of books that I owned, and that he was this shadowy figure that lived up the road in Lake Geneva. I'm from Chicago, so that's only about 90 minutes away. And so I never thought a lot about him, but I was just so interested when I read this first article that I had stumbled on, just that it seemed like not only did his life have a lot of really interesting stuff that we all know about, again, the controversies around the game, the dysfunction of TSR, the company that produced D&D, all these things that were really just kind of interesting on a very public level. But his life itself seemed like it had a really very interesting rags-to-riches-to-rags story. And I thought, gosh, I'd love to know more about this guy. So I actually looked for a biography about him, and I couldn't find one. And I was kind of blown away by that because as a gamer, as a lifelong gamer, the thing that really occurred to me about Gary and the movement he and Dave Arneson created, role-playing games, is that so many huge pop culture phenomena that we all take for granted these days, multi-billion dollar stuff, have their foundations in tabletop role-playing games. And that would be everything from MMOs, World of Warcraft, massively multiplayer online role-playing games, multi-billion dollar stuff, 10 million subscribers, everything to that from to computer role-playing games, Elder Scrolls and Might and Magic, to Fallout. I mean, you know, so you're talking about a really big cross-section of stuff. And then a lot of stuff that's a lot less obvious, probably, like even first-person shooter video games. You know, John Carmack and John Romero talk about they had just finished a long-term campaign of D&D before they created Doom, and a lot of the dungeon element of Doom and the idea of this first-person character assumption has its roots in tabletop role-playing games, you know, to say nothing of social media and a lot of other pieces that people really took concepts that were used to be unique to the tabletop. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that by the transitive property, I kind of came to the conclusion that, boy, this Gary Gygax, if he created this genre that became so formative and so important to things that are huge in pop culture today, this guy must be really important. And it's really interesting that you can't find that much about his story. So that's what really got my juices flowing about this, is this is a story that really needed to be told, not just a lot of the more well-known points of interest about TSR and about D&D and all this, but really about Gary's life. What was the guy like? What was he going through? And what was it about him that led to this what I call this empire of imagination, which is really the group of people that played this game and kind of subsequently went on to do great things and take over the world.
Wow. You know what? You hit the nail right on the head, because we don't realize that how so much that we enjoy now. As I was reading the book, I'm going through, and I'm starting to think back. I'm like, you don't realize that, like you said, the MMOs, and actually, I'm starting Fallout, and I'm like, all of this goes back to Lake Geneva, and it all goes back to Gary Gygax. And you brought out all of these points of interest, points of history for modern geeks and gamers that we took for granted, or that we take for granted. I have a question. What was the most surprising thing that you discovered while you were conducting your research? Because you hit me over the head with a few things. So I like to know, what was the most surprising thing for you?
Sure, Kylan. It's a really good question, because there was so much that I was surprised about that people didn't know about Gary Gygax. I mean, some people did. People I interviewed did. There was little mentions here and there. But so the things that really got my attention, in many respects, his childhood was classic Rockwell-esque child in the Midwest, up to Midwestern mischief, I call it. You know, he was playing pranks, he was running around, he was touring the abandoned insane asylum in town, the ruins of this place on a hill. I mean, it's almost out of a book, but it was a real place. That was this abandoned, asylum on the hill. You know, so all of this stuff, in that respect, it was kind of this wonderful and typical, very imaginative growing up. But the thing that I think shocked me about Gary, knowing how intellectual role-playing games are, especially this early stuff that he's writing, it's really complex, well-thought-out gaming mechanics that had never been done before, right? That's why Gary deserves so much credit, is because he was able to articulate and gamify something that was so complex and unusual in concept. And that's why it took really Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax to come together to make this happen, is because it took both their kind of creativity and their ability to game design to make this work. But what shocked me about Gary, again, going back to this idea how intellectual and complicated it all is, Gary didn't finish high school. He dropped out of junior year of high school. And so that I guess was a little bit stunning to me, not because I know a ton of brilliant people that either didn't finish high school or didn't finish college or whatever. That's not the big thing to me. I guess what the big thing was just how unbelievably intellectual the game is. And even the words, if you read some of the original, whether it be the player's handbook or even the original booklets, there are words in there you've never heard of or seen. And you're like, gosh, this guy must have had this unbelievably in-depth and actually somewhat archaic vocabulary that he would use, and he just really knew how to kind of craft this stuff. So the idea that he didn't finish high school, and I think on top of that, because it wasn't just that, it was a combination of things. It's that, the fact that he never drove a car, the fact that he never got a driver's license was shocking to me. And I think one of the biggest points of interest is that the fact that he had these two paranormal experiences when he was a child, or at least what he thought were paranormal experiences, those I think are just very interesting, because this influences this man that is already very imaginative, right? He's already into all these interesting things, pulps and all this stuff. And if you place on top of that a couple experiences they had when he was young, where he was convinced that he had touched something paranormal, that must have really added fuel to what was otherwise a very very active imagination. So I think it just made for a really interesting story. Again, this stuff I think is really the seeds of what D&D comes from.
Something that you brought out, and because it was something that I just assumed all along, having read the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the fact that he hated Tolkien, that he took his inspiration from the pulp novels, from it was more Conan and less Bilbo, I'm laying in bed reading this, and I'm kicking myself because it makes perfect sense. Because as I'm reading, in fact, I kind of went backwards. My experience was D&D, and then I start reading the Lord of the Rings, and it almost felt this weird disconnect, because I'm like, I'm reading this and there's adventure and I'm enjoying it, but having read, you know, some of the Conan books, I'm a huge fan of the pulp stuff. I get it now. I'm like, why? I can see where he chose that. You know, I guess the world that he crafted was more pulpy than it was, I guess you'd call it high fantasy, I guess. That was exactly. When you brought that out, I was just like, I mean, was that a jaw-dropping moment for you as well, or was that something that you knew coming into?
No. This all came out for me through my research. I have to admit, I didn't. I know a lot of people would know the designation right off the top of their head. I can't say I really could have ever told you that before I had really dug into the research of this whole thing. Fantasy was fantasy. I didn't realize that there was kind of basically a genre that was high fantasy, right? That's Tolkien. That's classic Lord of the Rings. He kind of reinvented the high fantasy genre. But at the same time, Tolkien is doing his thing. Robert E. Howard in the U.S. is creating this Conan thing through pulps, right? And this stuff it's in weird tales. It's not widely read. It's certainly not well respected in literary circles. But it's this swords and sorcery fantasy. Yes. Right? This is the stuff that gets Gygax's juices flowing. Because as you had already suggested, he didn't like Tolkien because it's not that he didn't respect the world building of Tolkien. As a matter of fact, I really think he did have a lot of healthy respect for Tolkien's world building.
Yes.
But as far as action, there was nothing going on in Lord of the Rings relative to what Howard was putting out with Conan.
Right.
And I think so basically, in a weird sort of way, Gygax cherry-picked the world building elements. And in fact, a lot of the characters, I mean, things like hobbits and Balrogs exist in the original D&D. And of course, the Tolkien estate took exception of that and they had to remove it later.
Right.
At TSR. But if you think about fundamentally what the gameplay of D&D is, the whole concept of storming a dungeon for treasure, well, gosh, I mean, Aragorn is never going to storm a dungeon and kill a bunch of things to get a bunch of treasure. That's not what he's going to do. But Conan might do that.
Yeah.
So, in a weird sort of way, the fundamental drive behind the adventure and the action of the game, it's really all swords and sorcery fantasy, Conan-type fantasy and Cole fantasy, not high fantasy like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
He said very explicitly the reason he included those Lord of the Rings fantasy elements in his game was because he knew that was the craze. Everybody knew it. Everybody loved it. So to get that audience interested in this fantasy game he was making, he included that stuff in a very overt level. But really, the gameplay is swords and sorcery.
Right.
Well, another thing I not moving too far away from that, but still on the book. Another thing I really enjoyed about this book was looking into the actual. You actually kind of. I like the way you put the business side of him building up the company and building the games without going so far into business that the regular reader is totally lost. It was interesting how he actually built TSR and how, without even noticing it, he lost it out from under himself without choices that he thought was the right choices, and all of a sudden he no longer has control of this.
You've got it exactly right. It's such a labor of love story, right? We've all seen this story before, and I think the TSR story, Gary's story around D&D, is everybody's interesting as, say, Apple or Facebook. You know, it has this, they start it because they love it, they're interested, but it turns out once money comes into the equation, right, once the business becomes a real business, things get really complicated because these people are not good business people. No. And Gary included. You know, not a one of them was really good at business. They were good at game design. They loved games. So it's that classic, you know, creative genius, you know, starts this company, starts this movement, and is ousted from his own company 10 years later based on some not perfect business decisions and a lot of other things going on that were spinning around the thing. But what I think is so intriguing is, I mean, it's just how surprising and interesting this whole thing happened. I mean, even the fact that his original business partner, Don Kay, died after a year, after D&D had started to reach success. Don Kay passed away unexpectedly, 36 years old. And that was the critical one-third interest of the company that shifted hands, that put Gary on the minority for the rest of his life of the company, so much so that he was able to be ousted from his own company. So it was a company where he was the figurehead and the founder, but he was never really in control. I think that element of the story is, again, it's one of the big things that I think made this story kind of that three-part interest I talked about. You've got the business side, which is totally interesting. You've got the controversy side, which is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got Gary's life itself, which in and of itself is just a very interesting story.
I found it interesting. It's almost like he didn't have a taste for the business side. Maybe at the beginning he did, but seems like because there was that mix of his still being able to develop games and okay, he had the business thing going on, but he was still developing the games, and that's where his heart was. And the two were hand in hand, and so he was fine up until, I guess, almost when TSR becomes a thing at that point. And it was even more interesting that he almost became a stereotype when he moves out to Hollywood. And I was like,
yeah, that was the right time to move out to Hollywood in the mid-80s.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my gosh, now, you know, and I right now I have the entire Dungeons and Dragons animated series. You know, and I loved it. You know, it's great. And I was hoping for more. But, you know, to kind of find out that you had all this other craziness going on in the background as well. He was a man of extremes, it seemed like. But it seems like all the really great creative geniuses are. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like he had a lot of that going on in his life, because you did a great job of giving us that picture of his life, along with the Gary Gygax that we know as the creator of D&D. But you gave us, you did this amazing job of giving us the whole picture, at least as much as you could. I came away from reading that pretty much with my jaw on the floor. So,
gosh, well, thank you for saying so. I mean, again, it was such a labor of love. And I think you can both recognize that I did some unusual ways with how I told the story, right? I used this very narrative nonfiction approach. Mm-hmm. And I say it in the author's note, you know, how do you tell the story of a storyteller, right? It almost seems irreverent to tell Gary's story in any way other than you're on Gary's shoulder watching as this stuff is happening to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose that very deliberately, you know, and I went through a lot of trouble, and it was a very challenging way to write because you're really trying to be, you know, absolutely as hard factual as you can, every scene, everything you can get into it. But you also, of course, have to take some liberties because I don't know what Gary's thinking at every moment. I don't know what Gary exactly said. I know that in this particular piece, perhaps, he wrote, oh, this is the essence of what I said. But I don't know exactly what the words were, right?
Yeah, right.
So you do your best to try to piece that all together and get the right spirit of every event and every conversation or whatever it was. But it was so important to me to do that because quite honestly, because I wanted the reader to really experience Gary's highs and his lows with him. I wanted them to be with him in his triumphs and experience his defeats with him, because I thought that would really give the reader a better sense of who Gary Gygax really was and the kind of stuff he was going through while he was creating this game that we know and love. I mean, a wonderful example is, you might recall, right before he creates the game Chainmail, he loses his job at the Fireman's Fund of Chicago. He's an insurance underwriter, right?
Right.
So here's a guy. He's in his mid-30s. He's been writing as an he's working as an insurance underwriter in Chicago for 10 years, grinding away like as we all do, you know, in our own ways. And he's got five kids, right? His wife is 9 months pregnant with Luke at this point. So that's his fifth kid. And this guy's back is against the wall, you know. And when I spoke to Mary Jo and she told me that Gary that day came home and he had this jug of Gallo wine. He had bought this jug of Gallo wine on the way home and he showed up on the doorstep and she knew something was wrong, you know. And you know, that's why I kind of opened that section with this whole concept of Gary showing up on his doorstep with this jug of Gallo wine. What must be going through that guy's head at that moment where he's, you know, he's working in games, but, you know, that's still a hobby at best. He's building community mm-hmm. through Gen Con and other things. And here's a guy that's got five kids to feed and this house to take care of, and he's got no job. I mean, what a scary thing. And this was the environment in which D&D grew up. So I just think it's such a fascinating story to hear these little vignettes about what was happening. Again, spending time with the guy that was going through all of this stuff and creating this game. And I think he had a lot of trouble achieving balance. I think he was, you know, I think as a gamer, he was absolutely obsessed. And then he would kind of go back and be a family man, gamer, businessman. I mean, you know, I think he wore a lot of hats. And I think he would readily admit, and I think he did late in his life, that, you know, he didn't always wear those hats as successfully as he wanted to. I think he really had trouble being pulled in a lot of different directions. As you had suggested, creative geniuses are often challenged in that way, and I think he absolutely was.
Yeah,
hey, you just managed to answer my next question. Well, because I was going to ask you what prompted such a unique approach in your writing style, but okay, but that's cool though. I mean, I'll put it like this: did you come away from this book? Did the whole experience of writing this book, did it change your impression of the man, or did it deepen it? Did it cheapen? Or I don't know. I mean, we all have our heroes, you know, and we know that our heroes are human, and sometimes it's hard to see that human failing in them. And
yeah, the old saying is never meet your heroes.
Right. And you did. I mean, you met Gygax through, you know, his ex-wife and business partners and people who played with the man. So I mean, how did you come out of this?
You know, that's an awesome question. It's actually one that I don't think I've been asked, actually. But, you know, I was joking with my wife during and after the book writing process that I was becoming Gary Gygax during the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you could see how it happens because, you know, here I am sitting in my little office and I was doing all-nighters writing the book. I was working my full-time job. I've got two kids at home, or I should say I had one when I started and I had two by the time I finished. And I started to feel – I mean I started to feel to a certain extent like Gary. I could start to really understand the kind of sacrifices that needed to be made to crank out, you know, this research or these pages or this chapter. And it always comes at the expense of something. You know, you got a couple of kids at home. You're either spending time with them and whatever free time you have, or you're working on a book or something. Right. And then, of course, my job has always been demanding. So in a weird sort of way, I felt like I got really close to the man. And if nothing else, I grew a real appreciation and a real understanding for the things that he did. And I do not in any way, shape, or form think he was in any way perfect, nor did he, nor does anybody, you know.
No, no.
But the thing that really stuck with me is that this people I spoke to, everything from his first wife, Mary Jo, all of his kids, his associates, these people love this man.
Right.
And for all of the faults that he had, for the temper, for all the things that he brought with him, this is a guy that people made sure that I knew, even if they were going to air out some dirty laundry, as it were. And a lot of people did. They were very, great to see that people were very honest about Gary, you know, his faults and his successes and everything else in between. But everyone made sure that they knew that they loved Gary Gygax, that they made sure that I knew that they loved Gary. And I think that really speaks volumes about him, mm-hmm. the kind of guy he must have been, the passion. And honestly, no, I mean, I can look at his life, I think, pretty, I don't know, objectively at this point and say, well, Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm seeing that this guy had a lot of failings, specifically in his first marriage, for example. As a father, I think he had fallen short in a lot of ways. You know, in some ways, as everybody does. As a businessman, he had fallen very short. When he, I think, Ken, you had mentioned his days in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, I think I grew a new level of respect because there had been a lot of talk about, oh, Gary, he was crazy and he was over the top and he was living on a mountain in Beverly Hills. And he was. I mean, that was probably some of his wildest time in life. I mean, it really was. I think he was a very ambitious guy. Things had blown up around this thing that he had created. And I think he did let himself get carried away, you know, for a certain period of time. But I look at all of that and kind of what happened in the subsequent years all the way through his death and the kind of humility he had grown, the kind of objectivity he had grown about his life, and really talking very candidly about, yeah, that was a mistake and I didn't do that well. And this guy had really found balance at the end of his life. That's something that I think is really interesting about him, is that it really does come full circle. It was a guy that was hungry and was full of piss and vinegar and all kinds of genius. And he had this very tumultuous life, only to end at a point where, way too soon, admittedly, but ended at a point where I think he looked at what he had done and said, wow, I'm pretty proud of that, you know? And not to give himself more credit than he was due, just I'm pretty proud of what I did. So to answer your original question, I grew an absolute new respect for the kind of stuff this guy went through and what he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, towards the end of the book, what kind of surprised me, but not really, because growing up in the 80s, I actually grew up in a conservative Baptist church. So mm-hmm. I remember all the stuff about D&D being Satan worship and these types of things. But seeing in the book where he had actually come to find a relationship with God after, towards the end of his life, and actually came back to the church, that kind of was amazing, considering all of the backlash he got from them in the beginning.
It's a remarkable I think that is actually a really remarkable thing. And you know, something that took me a while to actually figure out, you know, people had suggested I'm trying to remember. I remember some of his family members had suggested, oh no, some of his associates too. I remember Mentzer had mentioned this to me as well, that later in his life he started signing his emails with his favorite Bible passage, which yeah. is, I think it's Matthew 5:16, which is, let your light shine so that others will see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven, something to that effect. And, you know, and again, so you take that out of context and say, huh, that's really interesting. I wonder what's going on. Like, you kind of assume he's, you know, he's coming to some type of a religion. But it took a lot of different little sources and even a lot of his little message boards on Fans for Christ and some of these other online communities that he was a part of to piece together kind of how he had come to faith and about when. You know, he started having these health crises around 2004. And that's when things had really, really changed for him. You know, I mentioned in the book that he had been a Jehovah's Witness in the 60s and the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And he had a kind of tumultuous relationship with them, to be quite frank. I mean, Mary Jo, his wife, was really a lot more devout than he was. But he was a believer. He was a believing and practicing Jehovah's Witness. And there's a lot of writings at the time that absolutely support that, you know, this guy was definitely a believing Jehovah's Witness. So he falls away from that for a lot of reasons, one of which is the local congregation really doesn't approve of his lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And he falls away from that. And I think especially during the 80s period and quite a bit later, I think I don't think he's a man of particularly any strong faith. Mm-hmm. You know, he did later suggest that one reason he never brought up his faith during the Satanic Panic was that he didn't want to give the game a bad name. That is to say, as a Christian, he didn't want to suggest that the game had anything to do with that because it would give the game a bad name somehow. And he was trying to protect Christianity, as it were, right. Well, in his case, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some truth in that. Although I think the larger part is that I don't think he was really very attached spiritually during that period.
Okay.
Right. I think that's more accurate. And I think late in life, I think he becomes very active spiritually. I remember Elise telling me that he read his Bible every day on the porch of his Madison Street home. This is his last home. And he became very connected to it. Again, it took a while to piece that together because there was only certain people that knew Gary in that way. in that faith way. So it was pretty exciting to stumble on something like that pretty late in my research. Well, I should say not late in the research, but about late in the first year of the research process. Mm-hmm. I remember I stumbled on that, and I was kind of amazed by it because I heard all this other stuff, and I didn't really know how it all had come together, and I finally started piecing this together, and it was kind of exciting to see that kind of transformation he had made.
Well, you're talking about in the first year of research. How long did it actually take you to piece together? Because you reading the book, if anybody who hasn't read the book, the whole book is footnoted all the way through to let you know where you got all this information from, different interviews, different articles and things. How long did it take you from when you decided to try to do this project to finally got a chance to actually get it out into the hands of the public? How long was that process, and how did that go?
So it was about 3 years. It was about 3 years on the dot. I started as a master's thesis project, as I had mentioned, and mm-hmm. That first piece took a little bit over a year, maybe a year and, I don't know, a year and a quarter, something like that. And that was you would call that as a very – that's when I did a portion of the research. I mean, again, I'm going to say at that point I had probably done half the research of what ended up happening. Because what I did after I finished the master's project, which was a very abridged version of the final, mm-hmm. It was a different piece. I mean, it was. I could subsequently continue to do research interviews and more writing, of course, to continue to develop the book. And what I did at that point, by the time I had finished the master's, is I thought I had something that was starting to look kind of like a book. And that's where I got the idea. I'm like, gosh, I wonder, you know, because there's no biography about this guy, I wonder if this could be published. And that's when I started doing the literary agent process. I actually started querying literary agents. And I was delighted to get someone as renowned as a fellow named Jacques Despoulbert, who's my my agent. To give you some context on Jack, who's a remarkable guy, I call him the most interesting agent in the world. He's got this wonderful mid-Atlantic accent. He's this really distinguished, tall, well-spoken man in his 70s, kind of salt and pepper hair. You know, he's just a fascinating
guy. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And he was the original editor. You'll love this. He was the original editor of James Dickey's Deliverance, the book. When he was with Houghton Mifflin, he was the acquiring editor of Deliverance, and he edited the book with James Dickey, which, of course, became one of the greatest books of the 20th century, and, of course, the movie nobody ever forgets.
Right.
So that's where Jacques Despoulbert came from. He went into agency a few years later and became a very renowned literary agent. So Jacques was not a D&D player. The reason Jacques paid attention at all to my book proposal was because he remembered the game because his kids played it. His kids are about my age. And his kids played the game, and he thought it was just an interesting story. Then he started learning about this guy's life and thought, gosh, this is something great. So Jack and I teamed up, and he ended up selling the book to Bloomsbury a few months later. And the editing and expansion process with Bloomsbury took another, gosh, I don't know, another year and a half or whatever. So it was about 3 years beginning to end for this process.
Wow.
How difficult was it for you to actually, were the interviews and stuff you actually got with his friends and family and everybody that worked with him, was it a difficult process getting a hold of these people, or was there like one person that decided that helped you get in with everybody else, or how did that go?
Yeah, it was a domino effect for sure. You know, one reason I did take this, it's probably worth a note, one reason I took on this project. So when I was trying to decide these master's topics, one reason that a biographical project about Gary was so interesting to me was that because it occurred to me not only that had it not been done, I wanted to do something that hadn't been done for the purpose of the master's. Again, I wasn't thinking book at the time.
Right.
But the other part that I was really interested in was that as a lifelong gamer, it occurred to me that I would probably be able to have access to the people I needed to talk to. You know, while Gary and Dave Arneson are passed away, you know, you go to a convention and you can see the Hall of Famers of gaming. They're all right there. These are people that love to talk, and I mean it's part of kind of the foundation of gaming, right? These are people mm-hmm. that are very interested in connecting with people and talking and sitting around and telling stories. And so it occurred to me that I might be able to actually go up and talk to, oh, there's Jim Ward, oh, there's Tim Kask, there's Frank Mentzer. You see these guys at conventions. So I thought I might be able to actually get a hold of these. And I compare it to, say, writing a biography about, say, Bill Gates. If you tried to do that, you would have a lot of trouble getting access to the people you would need access to really get the straight scoop, really. Mm-hmm. But it occurred to me in this particular market, you know, gaming is so tight knit that I thought I might be able to do it. You know, even mm-hmm. me, you know, no one from Nowheresville might be able to actually talk to some of these guys. And I was delighted to find out not only were they willing to talk, but they were delighted to share their memories of Gary and their personal stories with me. And Ken, to answer your question, where it really started to click was a couple of my first interviews were Tim Kask, who was just delightful, then Steve Chenault, and Luke Gygax was the one that that roused all of the Gygaxes.
Okay.
And he was just a saint and roused all the Gygaxes so that he got me in touch with all of them. And then Ernie was unbelievably helpful. And so all of these things, it was a snowball effect. That's what I'm trying to say. It was a snowball effect. And this person would lead you to that person. It would make an introduction for you to this person. And that's really how it happened. It was very organic. And I didn't know if it would work at first, but it worked unbelievably well.
Cool. Well, you said, since obviously you've met all the Gygaxes and things, have they actually had a chance to read the book? And have you got their opinion on what they thought about how you depict their father's life here?
Oh, absolutely. They have been unbelievably gracious. I mean, they have been just absolutely ridiculously supportive of the thing. They love the treatment. And, you know, you can find if you look up, you know, if you see that, you know, kind of Ernie's comments in particular online, he's been very outspoken about how much he loves the book. Ernie has been just wonderfully supportive, as has Luke and Elise and Mary Jo and everybody else, really. They love the treatment. They think it's a very true-to-life treatment, and they think it's a very I think generally a very positive treatment of the father, and I think it's one that he deserves. So, yeah, they've been tremendously supportive. And I really didn't know how they would take it. I almost went into tears when Ernie read the book, and he wrote this unbelievable thing on Facebook about, you know, it was all that I hoped to be and more. He even said it brought him back to tears and many things where he had to stop reading. Because it was like he was walking next to his father again. I mean, it was very emotional for me and everybody else involved, truly. So I was really humbled by that.
Okay. I actually have, I think, two more things on my list. One, did you think, on other projects you might have coming up, did you ever think about possibly doing, is there more research possibly for the second? Because your book goes into a lot of details up till the point where he loses TSR, and until about 1990. And then... Right. Because I know the story focuses on his life with Dungeons & Dragons. But do you think about possibly doing another book that concentrates a little more on the second half there? Or do you think that story is pretty much done and you want to move on to someone else? Maybe like a Richard Atkins or Peter Atkins or like a Richard Garfield or someone else that's other like pillars in the gaming community. With Garfield starting Magic the Gathering, maybe yeah, Steve Garfield, Jackson, big time. Someone like that.
That's a great question. You know, I hadn't thought about, you know, someone like Garfield and he'd be a very interesting, kind of biograph, as would Peter Atkinson, who I know very well. I don't know Richard. The answer to your question is I don't think I would do another, I could see doing subsequent articles, things like that, kind of similar to what John Peterson does these days. If you know John Peterson's work with Playing at the World, which is really the foundational piece of role-playing game history. Another reason I had mentioned the style earlier, another reason I wrote my book the way I did was because it also had occurred to me that other people have written very good books already about the history of role-playing games. And a lot of that, of course, history is parallel track with Gary, right? It's not about Gary per se, but there's a lot of good stuff about Gary out there in a traditional nonfiction fashion. So I also wanted to do something different there. You know, John Peterson's book is a great example. It's a beautifully written traditional nonfiction piece. And it's extremely in-depth, you know, and my interest was, of course, more the story, right?
Yeah.
Versus getting really in the weeds of kind of how, you know, how this happened here and what Fanzine said this and you know, he begat her and so on and so forth. you know, and again, so I recommend Playing at the World to anybody. But to answer your question, John has been over the last couple of years writing a lot of kind of, you might even say supplementary articles that he writes on his blog and whatnot. And I could see doing some of that, especially for his later years, as you suggested, Ken. There was some more depth that I wish I had put into later in the book. Some of it I cut out very deliberately. But there were some pieces, if I'll be quite honest, that I would probably need to do some more in-depth work with say a Gail Gygax.
Okay.
Who I did not get to interview for the book. And Gail, I did request an interview, of course, and she very graciously declined at the time. She had a lot of things going on and she had just done a lot of interviews with the documentaries, those dueling documentaries that have been happening. And so I think she may have, whatever her reasons were, she had very graciously declined but wished me good luck and all that stuff. So I would probably need to spend a lot more time with her, frankly, if I was going to get a lot more depth out of those last, say, 10, 15, 20 years. Not 20, but 15.
Okay. Kylan, did you have anything else before we get ready to wrap this up?
I have just something that I remember. Okay, well, with Con on the Cob, we have something that's called a silent auction. And when you were talking about the TSR years, and especially it seemed like that there was this point where it seemed like people were wanting to make an RPG out of everything. Somebody had put in the silent auction, and I don't know if anybody bought it, the basic game set for Dallas, the RPG by TSR.
Awesome.
I was done. I have to, as I'm reading this, I'm like, did Gygax have a hand in that? Or did he just kind of like, that's off in some corner of the house and they're doing whatever? I just thought that was interesting, you know, because there was that point where if you could make a game out of it somehow, it seemed like that was happening. But it was nice to read this book and kind of put, put some real, so put some reality. I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. I guess almost, you almost dropped me right there in as it was happening.
Yeah, you basically put the man behind the name.
And I enjoyed that, yeah.
You put the man behind the name.
Yes.
No, that was certainly the goal. You know, I wanted gamers to feel like they were really there sitting at the TSR offices. They were really there sitting next to Gary as he was going through this stuff. You had mentioned Dallas, the role-playing game. Yeah, there was a time there. And to answer your question, Gary would have I can't confirm this, but it would be very unlikely he would have touched a game like that, per se. Yes. Largely because that probably would have been a licensed game during his period in Beverly Hills, where he really wasn't touching any of the games.
Okay.
He was working on TSR Entertainment. He was working on the cartoon series, which we all know and love. And he was working on trying to get a movie made, which, of course, never came to fruition during his time.
Right.
Yeah, that would have been fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of interesting pieces to it. But, yeah, there was – basically, that is a really interesting idea when you mention a game like Dallas or a little bit later, Buck Rogers, which there's a lot of reasons around that game why it was being produced and whatnot. But – the gist is that TSR started to really overexpand. The way they really got in trouble in the early 80s was that, first of all, none of them were very good businessmen. Gary was spending a fortune out in Beverly Hills trying to do media stuff that was had a lot of value in a lot of ways. I mean, gosh, right. You know, as a result of the cartoon, there was a lot of toy companies making D&D toys. I mean, it was all, you know, good stuff for the brand.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Blum Brothers are back in Lake Geneva trying to manage the fort over there, putting out games, some of which are really good. I mean, this is when things like Ravenloft are being born. This is when Dragonlance novels start to come out. So they're doing some really good work there, but there's a lot of stuff is coming out that's just not any good.
Right.
And so what happens with TSR in general over the next 5-10 years, and the reason they really almost go bankrupt and are bought by Wizards of the Coast is they really kind of just expanded in too many directions. I mean, right after Gary had taken over in 84, back over, you know, they had bought a craft company, a needlework craft company. You know, they were trying to really be in every part of every hobby and trying to be kind of everything to everyone, more of a conglomerate.
Yeah.
And they just weren't set up to do that. They were a game company, and they needed to kind of focus on their core stuff. So TSR gets themselves into a lot of trouble, especially over the subsequent years, by doing things like Dallas.
Yeah, which I love Top Secret. Top Secret was amazing. And, you know, that you can I'm still trying to find a Top Secret group out there because I loved Top Secret. But
we may have to start
I didn't realize that Dallas was a thing. I was like,
did you buy it? Because I'm not sure if I've ever seen that game. I have to admit that one is.
I did not buy it. I get a little sick just even saying.
I may know a shop around here that actually may have a copy of it hiding somewhere. Come on, Comics Over may have.
I think it was. I think the whole concept was, you know, you had your oil, baron, you had your rancher, you had, and I believe those were like the different player types.
Mm-hmm.
But you're RPGing a nighttime soap. I don't.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's.
Although, here's something you would like. This was the first – I did buy this. Somebody had pretty much all of the all the Dungeons & Dragons game books.
Mm-hmm.
This one with the bookmark. with the characters of D6 game.
That's awesome.
The Super Endless Quest. This was Prisoners of PAX. Yes, I have to admit, I know when I have my need to play D&D, but I don't, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I can't say, hey, let's get the gang together. I will pull this out and my pen and paper and my D6 and go.
That's awesome. That stuff is awesome. I mean, you know, one thing I'll say about, you know, Gary's late life, you had mentioned, you know, kind of whether I would ever come back, and I don't think I would come back and write another book about it per se. I don't know. One thing that was the most important, one reason that made it feasible is that I was able to talk to somebody who knew Gary at every point in his life. And I talked to a lot of people that knew him late in his life. And fortunately, he was a prolific writer. He had written a ton about what he was doing late in his life. So I felt like I was able to get a very good picture of what he was doing at every point. The thing that really made it really gel, though, for me was Mary Jo had known Gary since he was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And when I really thought about it, that was just a tremendous that was such a lucky, fortuitous thing because think of it this way. Everyone from Gary's youngest days would mostly be dead, or at least a lot of them already were. For whatever reason, a lot of his earliest friends had since passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mary Jo remembered his father. Nobody would have remembered his father because his father died very young. So having things like that happen were really fortuitous because Mary Jo could actually speak to remembering what Ernest Sr. was like, you know, after Gary was born. And, you know, things like that. So being able to talk to somebody that knew Gary at every point in his life was hugely important. And for that reason, I think we did a pretty good job of really telling the whole story and all the most important parts of the story anyway, through all the way to the end. It was a pretty remarkable process. And again, it's not to say there couldn't be a lot more depth. I hope someday that I can really sit down with Gail and get a lot more depth and interest, certainly late in his life too, because again, I was talking to a lot of people that knew him very well at that point, but Gail knew him, you know, as well as anybody for those last, you know, 15, 20 years. So someday maybe I'll try to, you know, put out a series of articles about that. But I think we did a nice cross section and Gary, you know, speaks for himself best. And I really wanted to make sure to get his autobiographical type stuff in there. You know, I really read very, very detailed stuff and message boards, thousands of pages to see what he was up to.
Awesome. One other thing that I just thought of is earlier this week I went ahead and bought the Audible version of the book so I could just lazy read through it real quick because I'd already read it. I have the book, but whose idea was it to have your brother Sam read the book on the Audible version?
So I asked him about it and he was very gracious and he was delighted to do it, and I was thrilled because I didn't want to put pressure on him. I mean, he's got plenty going on already, and he's well beyond anybody that we would have probably – with anyone that we would have been able to get to do the audio reading. I mean, he's obviously well-known in that space. Not audio book reading per se, but voiceover work, certainly. So, you know, I did float it to him and said, hey, you know, Sam, they've asked – you know, a lot of times when an author like me that has some background in performing and stuff, they'll ask us if we're interested.
Yeah.
And I thought about that a little bit. I said, you know what? I might do a decent job with this, but quite honestly, I want this to be done as well as it possibly can be done. And so that's when I thought of my brother and said, gosh, you know, Sam, do you have any interest in doing this? I said, I'd love to. I said, really? Great. Let's do it. So he got hooked up with Audible and they contracted him out to do the reading. And I think he did an unbelievable job with it. I mean, if I'll be honest, I think it's better than he made the book better than it is.
Yeah. Did you make any changes when they did the Audible version of it at all? Is there anything that you expanded on at all, or is it exactly word for word what the book is?
No, there's no expansion. There are a couple odds and ends that are tweaks that were small revisions, and sometimes we had, there might have been a word or a name or something wrong in the book that we updated. I mean, it's literally just a handful of things. So the answer to your question is it's basically word for word what the book is.
Awesome. Well, I know we've had you a lot longer than you expected to be here. I want to thank you for being on the show. Where could the Geeksters find you? Where are you going to be at that if someone wanted to come and talk to you about the book or anything? Do you have anything coming up, conventions or shows or anything else?
Absolutely. We've got GaryCon from March 3rd to March 6th. That's coming up next week. I'm actually doing a panel with all the Gygax children called Growing Up Gygax. I'm moderating, which is going to be really fun.
Nice.
We're going to have to write that down and put it on the show for tomorrow, Kylan.
So there's that coming up. I'll likely be at C2E2 in Chicago. I'll certainly be at Gen Con, likely doing a panel there, as well as Origins. And I'm trying to think. There's a lot of things. Grand Con coming up in September. West Texas Tabletop Convention coming up also in September. And a number of other odds and ends. I hope I'm not forgetting too much. But there's Printers Row Book Festival in Chicago. So it's a pretty long list, actually, of bookings this year. So you can actually go to my website and check out empireofimagination.com, and there's a news and events page where you can actually get my full calendar.
Okay.
As soon as I update it, anyway.
Oh, yeah.
What's coming up in the year.
I'll have to look you up at Gen Con, because I believe my wife and I are going to try to get out to Gen Con this year.
No, that's great. Please look me up.
Yeah, we've never been there before, so. But how can the Geeksters get a hold of you online? What are your different ways to get a hold of you there?
Absolutely, thanks. So, firstly, empireofimagination.com is a great place to find me, background, all that stuff. And my blog is also on there, The Last Gen Xer. also, you can find me on Twitter, at Mike Witwer. That's at M-I-K-E Witwer. You can also find me on Facebook. So I'm kind of all out there. And of course, the book you can find at any major bookstore, any indie bookstore, or, of course, online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and any other online retailer.
Awesome. Well, before we wrap this up, Kylan, you have anything else real quick?
No, I just thank you for your time and coming on the show.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, I want to reiterate that. Thank you for coming on the show and spending your time with us. This has been fantastic. And Geeksters, the book is Empire of Imagination, Gary Gygax, and the Birth of Dungeons & Dragons. Go check it out. I have a copy. I read through it. I don't read super fast, but I got through it pretty quick for a book. Kylan's read it, and both of us give us huge props. Geeksters, we'll talk to you here in a little bit.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
And we're back. How's that for an interview, guys? So, yeah. What'd you think, Ken?
That was awesome. I want to once again thank Michael Witwer. I've thanked him 27 times, but given us that the time he did and the fact that he had told us a half hour and sat here and geeked out with us for 50 minutes on the show and plus more time afterwards, you couldn't have asked for more. He is definitely a geekster like the rest of us, geek after our own hearts.
He really is. He seems like he's... Well, like you said, you know, he grew up with it. You know, mm-hmm. He was surrounded by it, so... It wasn't like he had just a mild interest. It is who he is.
Well, know? When he mentioned the mixtape VHS tapes growing up, the one that had Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, and something else on there, it's like, I remember those, because we had tapes like that growing up, but where my dad had taped off of TV, where we had, like, Ghostbusters, Ice Pirates, and something else on one.
Yep, because those tapes were 6 hours,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, as long
and
as
you
that
had to sit and watch the movie as you recorded it so you could take out the commercial.
Well, no, not if you taped it off of the HBO and places like that. But right. We didn't have that often, so.
Some of us didn't have cable.
Well, half the time you just leave the commercials in anyway.
Yeah, that was a run to get more Kool-Aid.
Yeah. So, but once again, everybody go check out Michael Witwer. Go to empireofimagination.com. That's where you can find everything Michael Witwer. From there, I believe in the interview, he told you about the social media and how to get a hold of him there. He is very approachable, guys. He'll answer and talk back to you with no problem. Check out the book. Kylan, where could they actually find this book? You like that?
Oh, you're good. Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, you know, you can go to geekwatch1.com and go to our sponsors page. And there's a nice little link that goes to Amazon. Click the nice Amazon link. Then type in Empire of Imagination and boom, there's a book in your hands.
Exactly. You can also get the audio version.
Days, but, you know, still.
Yeah. Well, you can get the audio version immediately for download off of Audible, which is also through Amazon.
And
that's true, too.
Who will read that to you?
And exactly. We found out on the interview, guys, Sam Witwer, Michael Witwer's brother, will actually read the book to you if you get the Audible version. So,
he won't personally read it to you, like, in your room or something, but it'll be in your ears.
Exactly. You close your eyes, and it sounds like he's right there beside you, whispering to you.
Don't tell him the secrets.
Sweet nothings as you lie in bed.
That's right. So,
you're snuggy with your cat.
So, you guys have anything else before we wrap this up, Miss, for Dawn or Kylan?
To let everyone know, in a few weeks, we're going to have our second quarter movies we're looking forward to rundown.
Oh, yeah.
And don't forget, we've also got the season two of Daredevil coming up that we're going to talk about. And Batman Love Superman is coming out soon, and we'll have our non-spoilery review that week.
That's right. And actually, what you were saying, why don't you tell them about the end of this month, what we're doing for that movie, movie review for the second quarter, Miss Dawn. We discussed this the other day.
What we're doing?
Yeah, where are we doing the movie review at?
We're gonna do our movie rundown at the next Meeplecast.
Yeah.
The last Monday in March, which I believe is the 28th. And we're gonna have everyone there can talk about what movies they're looking forward to. And if you're in the area, of course, as always, you can join us for some chat and some fantastic milkshakes and brownies and popcorn and all the other stuff they have.
Awesome. And remember, Geeksters, this is the second quarter. This is when we're starting to get into the summer movie season, where all the big budget movies are coming out. This one's going to have Civil War. I believe Ghostbusters is in this quarter. A lot of the big tentpole movies are going to be this quarter. So
Yeah.
Because it's April through June.
Yes. Yeah, that will. Yep, that's the yep. At least the very beginning of the summer. So, mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So, Miss Dawn, Kylan, thank you for coming on the show.
What,
Miss Kylan? Oh,
I'm used to bringing in Miss Dawn, Miss Vicky. So,
here. Secrets,
guys. As always, you can find us at GeekWatch1.com, and now as of last week, you can find us everywhere at GeekWatch1 on Facebook, Twitter, everywhere else. Also, the email is GeekWatch1@gmail.com. Send us your thoughts. If you liked the interview we did, let us know. If you didn't like the interview, you want us to be quiet with people and just talk with just us sitting around. I don't see that, but hey, if you want to hear that, let us know. For Kylan, for myself, for Miss Dawn, for Miss Vicky, and thank you, Michael Whitwer. Just remember,
no matter where you go, there you are.
You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.